The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way. And that's with Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts and help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's designed by real people for real conversations, and their tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/bluewire. That's 60% off at babbel.com/bluewire, spelled BABBEL.com/bluewire. Rules and restrictions apply.
From your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Robin. Welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Wednesday night, May 8th, 2024, as we record this episode after the Chicago White Sox just completed their series in Tampa, concluding their six-game road trip after two rather non-competitive games against the Rays. The White Sox won on Wednesday night thanks to terrific pitching from sexy Chris Flexen and a big home run from Paul DeJong. Expected, of course. Big performances from those two. That win closed a 500 road trip for the White Sox as they won their series against the St. Louis Cardinals and took one out of three against Tampa. But taking that one game means that the Chicago White Sox clinched their first season series against an opponent as they won 4 out of 6 against the Rays. So there you go. At least that's one feather in the White Sox cap in 2024. We'll recap that series, preview the upcoming Guardians series as Cleveland rolls into town, starting a 7-game homestand for the White Sox. Oh, and the White Sox made another trade, sending Robbie Grossman to the Texas Rangers. Lots to discuss, so let's get started. Joining me are Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And hello, James and Jim. Despite a franchise worst start to a season, the White Sox clinched a 500 record road trip and a season series against the Rays. Jim, is the regression pendulum swinging back to the White Sox favor?
A little bit. I think you can say when they've, you know, had a decent road trip, a series win in St. Louis, avoiding a sweep against the Rays, both teams with ambition and dignity. That's got to be pretty decent for what the White Sox are trying to do in terms of just like playing like a major league team and not a team that looks like they could be optioned down to the International League and replaced with, well, maybe not Charlotte, maybe replaced with Birmingham, and nobody would know the difference. So there's that. Still not seeing like the huge swings in progress like you want to see from like Eloy Jimenez, like kind of consistent upward trajectory. Same thing with like Andrew Vaughn and such. So you're not seeing like necessarily the sources you want to see providing this regression. Like you're seeing it from like Brian Ramos, you know, nice competent play from somebody kind of thrown into a situation he may not have been ready for. Paul DeJong coming up with some moments when you don't necessarily expect him to be doing it, which is all well and good. But in terms of like the feel good regression is not quite there, especially with Luis Robert Jr. being, I guess having a small setback in his rehab, but like he might not be at the earliest end of his timetable. So in terms of like the stuff that might last a while, like the stories you could think you might be able to apply to future seasons, not quite there. But in terms of like this roster is full of names like regular baseball and not regular baseball fans, but just like, you know, avid baseball fans from other markets would recognize as major leaguers. Like they should not be 8-28. So 9-28 is a little bit closer to, I think, how bad they should be or how good they should be overall.
Yeah, there's 125 games left to go this season. If you are a White Sox fan hoping or believing that they could win 10 more games than they did last year, all the White Sox have to do is go 62-63 in their last 125 games. Totally doable, right, James? They could play 500 baseball the rest of the season. They played 500 baseball the last six games.
I thought we were just being shifted to just trying to avoid setting a record for losses. I don't know if this 10 more wins from spring training thing came. Like, that was said like by Steve Stone, like before the cease trade, decades ago. Irrelevant to where we are now. History has passed on and rendered the face of Earth unrecognizable to the generations before us. No, I don't think that's very reasonable. They traded Roddy Grossman today. They'll trade more. They'll do it again. They will probably be, a decidedly weaker team in August than they would be in July. Like, there's other drop-offs to account for. My road to show White Sox team that ill-advisedly called my 18-year-old prospect up at the end of the year, they lost like 110 games. That seems reasonable. That seems like the talent level hit. Maybe the White Sox won't like bring up an 18-year-old who puts up a 7 ERA for 2 months, and that will make them a little bit better than that simulation. But otherwise, that seems like the sort of, like, 100-loss team, probably, the best bet for the worst record in baseball this year, but not a lock and not setting history. Something that, like, we'll remember in a bad way, but, like, will be a local shame, not like a national shame.
Okay, so that's what they're aiming for. Just be a local embarrassment.
I think they're aiming for higher, but, like, what I'm thinking of, like, oh, I don't have to do a stat head search on, like, whether they're on the worst pace that they've ever been on time. I can just check the game notes and just see that they're on the worst start for the franchise of all time. Like, I don't have to do my own research.
As Jim mentioned, a little positive, Brian Ramos, 5-14 to start this season through his first five games. He's got a double now, 2 RBIs. He did draw his first walk of his career, and he's only struck out once so far in five games. Ramos has been doing a very good job.
Very troubling and bad for the overall team direction. They won a game because of Chris Flexen and Paul DeJong. They traded Robbie Grossman for a decent-looking relief prospect, and Brian Ramos had, like, a big game. They are simultaneously justifying never spending $2 million AAV on a major league free agent ever again, or giving an international free agent more than $300,000 bonus ever again. If they can get this level of production in a single day from just shopping the bargain bin, like, if you could find this at TJ Maxx, why would you go to Macy's?
Yeah, good point. Good point. Well, speaking of trying to bargain shop, the White Sox are the first two games of this series, not very competitive games against the Rays on Monday and Tuesday, large part due to starting pitching. Mike Clevinger was brought in to stabilize the rotation. He made his 2024 debut on Monday. He was awful. There's no other way to sugarcoat it. Did not strike out anyone. He walked four batters. He just looked like a pitcher who is not ready for the majors, and we'll see what he does at his second start against Cleveland. Tampa had 21 swings against Mike Clevinger in three innings. They whiffed once. So, yeah, Clevinger's got a lot of work to do to prevent having a disastrous start in 2024 and questioning, again, why the White Sox brought him in. But, James, I'm a little bit more curious about Mike Soroka. So we've seen Soroka a handful of times here. It's 7-plus starts. How much more runway does Michael Soroka have left in proving he should still get the ball every fifth day?
I would be tempted to think he has close to the All-Star break. Like, the seemingly the pressure on him would be like Nestrini and Cannon from below, which I think there's, especially with them pitching in Charlotte, it's going to be like kind of a mixed bag as far as like them putting up like a dominant run that makes like, oh, we got to do something. Like, that's going to be pretty hard for him. And they're just Cannon just not being all that experienced, and the Strini's command kind of being in and out. I have a hard time seeing them like putting a level of dominance that makes them like alter their timeline or speed up projects based on that. So him surviving the Brad Keller affair, where they basically picked the stick with him over Kells in a rotation, speaks to something. I think it's a, you know, a project. It was one of their main projects, the rotation, of getting him right. That said, like, it's not like a ton of progress going on. He'll have some starts where he keeps it together and, you know, makes fewer of his own problems. But the sinker is not really back to where it was, and he doesn't really have much for lefties right now. So he's been hopeful. He thinks mechanically that he can get up to more mid 90s. I think if he hit 96 in a game and was living a bit more 93, 94, that would probably be a different prospect than how much he's 91, 92 right now. And if he feels healthy, like, that's logically in there. But right now, like, the current, his splits are like pretty even, which they must have evened out recently because they were very jagged earlier in the year, but they're both even, and like both sides have an 840 OPS against them, which is not, you know, proof of concept. But largely long term, in terms of like getting him back to saying this is a starter, I think like having a fastball that he feels like he can actually throw the lefty, because right now he just has to spam them with like off speed as much as he can get away with, doesn't make me think like the starter project is like really in a great place going forward to get value out of it. So that said, it's something that they care more about than flipping this guy than saying rushing the Strini or Cannon up in any way, or you know, skipping on steps of development. So I think they'll go with it a little bit longer, and certainly if they trade like as many starters as they hope, maybe there's still a spot for Soroka second half to just eat innings that they need eaten, and that's a reason to kind of keep him stretched out until then. So I don't think he's like winning it on merit, but I also don't think that they're hyper motivated to abandon this project for the sake of like, you know, stuff that they're not really looking to do that soon anyway.
Yeah, I bring up this point, Jim, because the White Sox are now 1-7 and Soroka starts it again. The White Sox are not a very good team, but in each of Soroka's 8 starts, the opposing team has scored 5 or more runs. And he has 23 walks to 20 strikeouts. And I don't want to say, because this is where it really pops the morale balloon for fans. And I don't want to pile this on Michael Soroka, because he's trying to overcome some devastating injuries to get back to being a major league pitcher. But the amount of walks, the very few strikeouts that he has, in 7 of his 8 starts, he's allowed at least one home run. He found a way to only allow 3 hits to Tampa Bay, but the 4 walks and still allowed 4 runs. Like, teams are very efficient when they get on base against Soroka in scoring those runs. This is where, I don't want to say it's like an automatic loss, but it does have me scratching my head. At some point, we're going to hear fans in June wanting Nastrini or Cannon or somebody else to come up and replace Soroka. Like, that's why I wonder just how much runway Soroka has.
Yeah, it's tough when you're watching a guy with, like, he's got a 6.34 ERA, and usually it's hard to have a FIP higher than that, but Soroka actually does because of the walks and the homers, compounding all the other issues that he has. But I watched Flexen tonight, and I think you can see like a couple differences in terms of like watching him versus watching Soroka. With Flexen, when he's getting lazy flyouts, that's how he's always done it. Just like messing with hitters' timing just enough to get contact off the barrel, or either at the end of the bat or on top of the bat, to where like launch angle isn't optimal, and all of a sudden you're through 5 or 6 and he only has like 3 strikeouts, but for whatever reason, the contact that they're making is not the kind of contact that can land safely. So it doesn't seem sustainable, but he's had runs like this with other teams to where, like, it's not a case where it's, you know, going to look good, but it's going to work for at least a while. Also, Flexen showed that he can go to the bullpen and pitch out of a role that's not necessarily comfortable or predetermined, and he adjusted. So he provided the White Sox some use that way. So one way or another, Flexen has proven that he can do the job well enough for a team that's this bad. I think with Soroka, when you're seeing him struggle this much and not being able to find any kind of mode to succeed in a way that he did with Atlanta, or finding another way to reinvent himself, and also he's pitching on the most carefully programmed circumstances that the White Sox can afford him, it's hard to know where you go from here. Do you just try to throw him in a long relief outing and say, you know, Brad Keller's out pitching you right now, let's go to Brad Keller and see what Soroka does in relief? Or do you just say, not working out, there's not going to be trade value here. There might be more trade value in Brad Keller, so let's try to shine him up and see what happens. And that's when Soroka gets the boot. But I think for as long as there's uncertainty and as long as they keep cycling through like Jared Schuster every other week, they probably need innings from somewhere. And Soroka is at least throwing like four innings, five innings, and you don't feel bad about like him being overmatched or in over his head the way you might look at a Cannon or an Estrini and think like, well, if we go to them and after DFAing Soroka and they continue to struggle, where do you go from here? Yeah. So I think maybe another month, and then you buy yourself enough time to give a prospect a longer look and not feel bad about it, but probably through May, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Flexen, Jim, because Chris Flexen was excellent on Wednesday night. Six innings, allowed just three hits, one earned run, struck out eight, and walked one batter in his last
0% ground ball rate.
0% ground ball rate.
Hey, they turned three double plays.
Yes. No ground balls, three double plays. In his last five appearances spanning 22 and a third innings, Chris Flexen has only allowed four earned runs. So a couple starts, a couple bullpen appearances, but Flexen's been pitching much better for the White Sox, especially his last two outings against the Twins and Rays. 11 innings through two starts, only allowed three earned runs. That at least gives the White Sox an opportunity in the first half of games. And then we'll see in the battle of the bullpens, and that's been shaky for some games for the White Sox. But if they're trying to avoid being the worst team in White Sox history or one of the worst teams ever in Major League Baseball history, they could use some help with the starting pitching front. I know I'll get some heat on this, especially for those that comment on our YouTube page. Clevinger's got to be better. No excuses. I get that he didn't have spring training, but he told everyone and he sold everyone in the idea that he was working out and he was getting himself ready, and he was awful. He's got to be a lot better against Cleveland. I'm glad that he's happy that his velocity was there. One whiff on 21 swings will get you crushed no matter what team it is in Major League Baseball. He's got to be more competitive than he was on Monday for the White Sox. Now, flipping over to the offense, I was curious about this reaction Tuesday night after the White Sox lost 5-1 to the Rays. In the postgame show on NBC Sports Chicago, Ozzie Guillen is having a really tough time following this White Sox team. He's not alone. But after that loss, Ozzie along the line said that this is hard to watch every day when there's no accountability. And Jim, Chuck Garfine followed that up, venting about Pedro Grifol continuing to bat Andrew Vaughn, third or fourth in the lineup, as an example of this is someone who has no accountability, because no matter how bad he's at the plate right now, Pedro Grifol continues to put Vaughn third or fourth in the lineup. Lo and behold, on Wednesday, Vaughn did reach base three times. He had an infield single. He had a double, his seventh of the season, and he did draw a walk. Seven games into the month of May, Andrew Vaughn is batting 200 with a .231 on base percentage and slugging .280 this month. You may think those are terrible numbers. Those are better numbers than he had in the month of April, and Vaughn still does not have a home run. So I pose this question to you, Jim. Has Andrew Vaughn become this season's issue, what we discussed about Tim Anderson last year?
I think as long as Andrew Benintendi's contract is his contract and there's no way around it, then yeah, I think Vaughn probably becomes that guy, because when you look at the White Sox defense and you see just how bad they are as a team, and you see like Gavin Sheets in right field doing his best out there, plodding along and realizing that he's out hitting both Eloy Jimenez and Andrew Vaughn and still has to play in right field because he has to play there. It does feel like there is a, there's no meritocracy in that corner or those three positions, But also, Vaughn's been doing this now for 4 years, and it feels like there should be some more progress towards, you know, something more meaningful. And so I think there, because Anderson could be cut at the end of last year, or, you know, they could just not exercise his option and he could be let go. There was talk about his future and whether the White Sox would be, you know, moving on. And I think with Vaughn, you know, he has arbitration years after this. And I think it's probably too strong right now to say he'll be non-tendered, but there is that possibility. Like if he hits $200 a year and they look at his arbitration figure and don't want to pay it, like you could see them maybe entertaining that discussion. So I think that's what makes him probably more of an ongoing thing versus somebody like Benintendi, who's playing nearly as poorly. And, you know, you could have the whole accountability thing with, you know, still playing left field every day, still batting, you know, sixth or higher every day and not producing a whole lot. But it's really just a matter of like how much Jerry Reinsdorf is willing to eat of his contract. And that's probably too early of a conversation to have. So Vaughn does seem like he's the best candidate for it because, like, yeah, Jimenez, you know, his option will be pretty easy to decide on. Same thing with Moncada. Vaughn will be the debate. And so that makes him interesting in that regard.
I mean, he's not going to make a lot in arbitration if he continues to hit this poorly. But on, like, the accountability front, James, like, the reason I bring up Tim Anderson is that no matter how many times Jim and I kept pointing out and just the struggles for Tim Anderson, Pedro Grifol consistently batted Anderson leadoff. And I know last year you asked Grifol straight up why he was doing that. And then he didn't think about ever doing that, or said that at least publicly. And the next game he drops from the order. So Anderson's batting second, which completely defeats the purpose of what we're all clamoring for. Like, if the guy's struggling, drop him down to the bottom third of the lineup. Like, does it make sense at some point if Vaughn is just doesn't have any home run power that you swap DeYoung and Vaughn? Because now Paul DeYoung leads the team in homers with 5. DeYoung's the one that's batting 7th and 8th, while Vaughn continues to bat in the prime spots of the middle of the order.
Yes, it does make sense. I get why it takes a bit longer at this group, because there's not like full of obvious candidates. Like if Brian Ramos was here to stay, or if we thought he wasn't overmatched, I guess I'd think about him moving up. Like, I don't think DeYoung will benefit really greatly from being a three hitter. He's producing with like what he does when he makes contact, but like a 37% strikeout guy in the middle of your order. It's not always the greatest for flow and like run creation. I think a slot down where it's a like, hey, he ran into one, it does something, is probably a bit more ideal. But when like you have multiple 500 OPS guys in front of him, it's not like a luxury you can really wait for. With Tim last year, you know, the thing that Pedro kind of kept falling back on is like the structure under which their offense works is with Tim as like a top of the order guy. Like, acknowledging it happened, you know, it needed to happen because he was not that guy, but they didn't really have like a way that things would work, or, you know, obvious candidates. I mean, we're still watching them cycle through good candidates to do that. And then they traded one of them away today as well. Not that that wasn't the right thing to do. So I feel like he has a hard time like envisioning like what the offense would look like without Vaughn up or near the middle. I certainly think if Gavin Sheets was like a sure thing to be in the lineup every single day, that would be an easy thing to figure out. Or if you wanted to, and slowly but surely they say that they're kind of going to make Corey Lee a regular fixture, and he's, you know, consistently north of 700 OPS, that seems like somebody to shift up and move Vaughn down, or move Benintendi down. Even if I don't think, you know, if I think, you know, three or four hitter would be asking too much of Corey Lee on a day-to-day basis to make him the centerpiece of all scouting reports of the opposition would be a little harsh. I think, especially with a first baseman and the level, how low it is and how little value he's providing outside of it, he does seem like the prime target to do it. And I think they should, but I also get why you look at this group and your options for it to shuffle around and just think of like, let's give him another week, see if he finds it.
Yeah.
Cause I don't like what I'm doing for any things I have to adjust, but it's a week and a week and a week. And then we're in September. It's like, oh, Tim Anderson had one of the worst seasons of all time. How did that happen? Tim's actually hitting worse this year, which is just just becoming a hardcore bummer to see.
Yeah, that's been a blog idea I've had and swirling my head, Jim, is old friend alert and just checking in and all the old friends of the White Sox. And it's not good. It's like, it's super depressing when you go down that road.
Not Dylan
Not
Cease.
Not Dylan Cease, though.
Not Dylan Cease.
Not Reynaldo Lopez.
And Reynaldo Lopez, yeah, but for White Sox hitters.
They're living their best lives right now.
It's ugly.
Okay.
Looking at weighted
runs. When they're handing each other the ball in the NL All-Star game.
That'd be awesome.
That'll make up for the rest of it.
That'd be awesome.
Kevin Pillar, two homers. There you go.
I was going to get to Pillar in a moment, but out of the White Sox hitters right now, with Yoan Moncada and Luis Robert Jr. still on the mend, Pedro Grifol only has four batters with an above league average weighted runs created plus. Tommy Pham, Gavin Sheets, Corey Lee, and now Paul DeJong. That's it. Everybody else is way, way, way below league average. So, Jim, I'm going to toss this crazy idea to you because I'm still not comfortable tossing crazy ideas to James unless he just wants to completely crush my spirits here. But I did like the idea of what Grifol went with on Wednesday to give him props is having Tommy Pham bat leadoff. Does a Tommy Pham, Gavin Sheets, Corey Lee, and Paul DeJong 1-4 give the White Sox the best chance to score as many runs as possible, and then just figure out, maybe draw names out of a hat 5-9?
On one hand, I would say no, just because you're entertaining like a lot of strikeouts, especially like if you're looking at three righties who might not match up well against a righty, like not looking great, and Sheets has platoon problems against the left side. So, like, it's not perfect in that regard. However, I think in terms of if you want a little bit of that accountability or that merit-based reasoning to come into play, management to come into play, and you look at that lineup and you say, like, these are all four guys who have been playing well, sure, as a reward, as an acknowledgement of what everybody is seeing, both in the dugouts and clubhouse and also, you know, the broadcast booth and fans, they're all there acknowledging these nice little stretches these guys are having. So sure, I don't think it could hurt. I think, you know, the White Sox offense disappears enough as is to where there's nothing to disrupt. So I don't mind Grifol getting crazier with the permutations. I don't think it's crazy, but more for a lack of just like how, in the absence of anything resembling a reliably productive lineup, sure, go nuts. Like the good kind of crazy.
And the reason why Andrew Vaughn's been batting in the middle of the order, again, we're sticking with this accountability theme, is because Vaughn supposedly is really good with runners in scoring position. Well, he's not this year. He's got the second most at-bats with runners in scoring position. He's 6-for-31 hitting, no extra base hits, 6 RBIs. So he's got a 491 OPS with runners in scoring position. Andrew Benintendi has the most at-bats with runners in scoring position. His OPS is 606. He's 7-for-33 with those two homers against the Rays and 12 RBI. So the home runs picked up a lot of the RBI total there for the White Sox. Gavin Sheets has an OPS over 1,000 with runners in scoring position. He's 9-for-26 with the homer and 10 RBIs, 4 walks, and just 2 strikeouts and 4 doubles. I can't believe I'm saying this, James, but the more I think about this whole lineup situation and the whole idea of accountability, stop automatically putting guys in the middle of the order who do not deserve to have those at-bats because of their struggles. You got to build this White Sox offense around Gavin Sheets. Is that where we're at today?
Well, theoretically, it'd be a lot easier to do all the things we're talking about if they had Luis Robert and Yoan Moncada, because then it would be a lot more natural to shift pieces down with guys who would not look out of place in the middle of the order, have some measure of on-base ability and power at the same time, and don't and you're not like Wayne, whether it was like with Corey Lee or Brian Ramos or, you know, Paul DeJong, just them getting kind of super exposed or their flaws being put in like under a microscope by putting them in the middle order in a way that it hasn't before. DeJong's like produced, but I also think like he's perfect where he is. He's got like this 38-3 strikeout to walk ratio. I don't think he's going to be like the guy who you like can always count on the move to runner type of like hit profile. I think he's perfectly situated as like, oh, he didn't make contact. Oh, that's fine. It's about him. Turn the order over. Let's get over. Like, oh, he ran into one and it went 500 feet. That's amazing. Here's a treat type of thing where I get why he's down there. But yeah, it would seem like they're almost a little bit handicapped until those two get back to really kind of move pieces around. Cause it's like, well, we have our five set guys we're working with and then four fill-ins that we're kind of not sure where to hide. And that doesn't allow for like a lot of traditional lineup creativity, but it's also just, you look at the lineups, there's just not enough creativity to kind of figure out ways to produce. And like theoretically it should not be like super locked into a 500 OPS first baseman. But that's kind of the way the White Sox roster and organizational depth is at right now. But yeah, I think, yeah, it's premature to talk about, but I think Vaughn's certainly not hitting like someone who gets like tendered through the last years of their arbitration as a first baseman. I think you need to be solidly above league average to do that. And he's, you know, I think his best years have been kind of only incrementally over that. And to have this kind of bottom out season when you're already kind of facing this cliff of, you know, there's 1 to 2 years before any of this is relevant or means anything, how long are we going to, you know, commit to this project that's, if anything, getting diminishing returns and at best is probably not strong enough to really project as someone who's part of your future core.
And then to follow up with you, James, Daryl Van Scowen of the Chicago Sun-Times wrote about this. Pedro Grifol, Chris Getz spoke about Luis Robert. There's been a minor setback in his recovery. What are you hearing about Robert? When there's a minor setback, I think there was the hope that maybe Robert could return to the team next week. Is there still hope that he could return to the White Sox before the end of May?
I would think, I mean, it's to be decided. It's like he was a week away or was supposed to go to like his rehab stint next week. And now if that's on hold until he feels better, he ramps up, then it's a little bit harder to project. If you say everything goes perfect from now, you'd probably just tack a week on, but it's kind of more like how it response. So yeah, I wouldn't say it's like been eliminated in any form as far as him getting up before June, but without kind of an actual projection date until like he's ramping up again, you can't set your watch to it.
Well, we're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors, but coming up after the break, we'll talk about the White Sox trading Robbie Grossman to the Texas Rangers. Who is the new AA reliever the White Sox are getting in return, and preview the upcoming weekend series as the Cleveland Guardians visit Chicago. Game Time is now an authorized ticket marketplace of Major League Baseball, which makes getting tickets even faster and easier. Prices on the Game Time app actually go down the closer it gets to the first pitch, with killer last-minute deals, all-in prices and views from your seat, and their lowest price guarantee. Game Time takes the guesswork out of buying Major League Baseball tickets. For this weekend's Chicago White Sox vs. Cleveland Guardians series, Game Time has tickets starting at $10 for each game, but you can treat yourself and grab tickets behind the White Sox dugout in section 138 for $68 a seat. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets with Game Time. Download the Game Time app, create an account, and use our promo code SOXMACHINE for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply. Again, create an account and use our promo code SOXMACHINE for $20 off. Game Time. Last minute tickets, lowest prices, guaranteed.
It's done. Goal of the year, Panarin! Part of the past, the celebrations forgotten, the history,
Vegas Golden Knights.
History, we're back to a blank slate, clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Welcome back to the Sox Machine Podcast. Before Wednesday's game, Chris Getz made a move as the Chicago White Sox trade Robbie Grossman to the Texas Rangers, which Robbie Grossman was part of the Rangers team that won the World Series last year. So that's convenient for him. He gets to pick up his World Series ring and return to the Texas Rangers, who are currently going through some outfield injuries right now. And Wyatt Langford very talented, but not hitting as well as the Rangers thought he would when joining the majors. The Rangers could just use some more outfield depth. So here's Grossman to help out, ease the pain as they deal with some injuries. And James, what should we know about the new guy the White Sox have received, AA reliever Anthony Hoopy Tuiantoa, as he joins the White Sox?
He throws a little above the mid-90s, 96-97. Some people put it 94-99. I feel like 96-97 is probably a good way to say it. I think the scout I talked to put it best was, he's the definition of something. He throws decently hard. It's not super special. They actually like this changeup. Other outlets have written about a slider more. But it's three pitches. It's good numbers. He was a 30th round pick out of a community college, but he's actually a 16th round pick out of high school, and he didn't sign and then did not collect his winnings. But he was great in the Arizona Fall League. He hasn't given up a run since last August. He's, you know, that's, you know, AA relief works. It's not maybe the same as like Bobby Jenks' streak, but it's encouraging that he's been productive against, you know, prospect laden environments, especially in the AFL. The strikeout rate is like 34% right now with like sub 9 walk rate. Like, the numbers are great. It's just not like this huge pedigree that suggests like necessarily closer stuff until he proves it. And he's also not got like this super eye-popping stuff profile where people are talking about as like this freak reliever from a special release point, but you know, he's got the tools to be a decent guy, and you know, he's succeeded at advanced levels, and you know, certainly at the relief depth we've seen explored with this team, and you know, already seen a little bit of Prolander Ballora, Jordan Leisure basically becoming the seventh, eighth inning guy out of spring camp. It doesn't seem crazy that you would see him up at some point, and you kind of need to, because it was kind of surprising he didn't go into Rule 5 last year, and so it would be even more surprising if he didn't go into Rule 5 again this year. It's kind of nice to get him in a trade for some guy you signed in a minor league deal rather than Rule 5, because now he can go to AA and be normal, have three option years and whatnot, and not be someone that you're trying to like hide on the roster the way that, like, I'm unconvinced that Shane Drohan will ever work in the kind of Rule 5 get him through a season atmosphere. It'd be much nicer if you can get him to AAA, but it's a decent get for basically Robbie Grossman, who at the end of spring, we're like, oh, they signed Robbie Grossman for a minor league deal. Great. It's fine. Like, I want to say it's quite found money, because I don't think Jerry Reinsdorf probably feels that way, but it's something for what we thought was initially nothing or negligible. So I don't think it's necessarily like future closer. I wouldn't put him on the same caliber is Leisure, but it's depth, it's useful. All Sergio Santos needs as many weapons as possible to win a Southern League title. He can't just ride Edison Coffee into an early grave. And you know, the White Sox are loading up for the one playoff chase that matters.
Yeah, I was gonna say, Jim, the Birmingham Barons got stronger today with this trade. And it lends the idea, because the White Sox have so many of these veterans like Robbie Grossman on one-year deals. Is this a type of trade that should set expectations for White Sox fans on the types of players Chris Getz could get in return for these veteran rentals before the trade deadline ends at the end of July?
It's, you know, when it comes to this kind of deal, and the White Sox have so many of these types of players that they're basically like baseball's extended spring training. They take a veteran who can't find a home anywhere, give him a little bit of run, the rest of the league can see what he looks like, and then pick him up for like a player that they can't use or can't fit in a 40-man roster. The thing about those players is they tend to be like relievers, or maybe thinking about like a guy the White Sox lost or traded away because they couldn't quite fit him in on a 40-man, like Cade McClure, so like a tweener between a starter and a reliever. Like, it always feels like for these kind of trades, if he turns into like a useful reliever, that helps. But when you look at trying to trade five or six guys with the same profile, even if he extended to like Paul DeJong and Nicky Lopez, I think it's either going to come back to relievers or, you know, starters who don't have enough in the minor leagues, or it's going to be on the very other end of it where you get like 17-year-olds that you hope can maybe give the White Sox a Fernando Tatis Jr. like story. But otherwise, you know, lottery tickets to the extreme. So that's why in isolation, or at least as a first move, this is fine. And it's a good use of all the innings that the White Sox will have to cover over the next several months. But I think in bulk, it's a hard thing where after a couple of these moves, it won't feel as fresh or novel. And you'll look at the 40 man and say, well, still a lot of pitchers and still not a lot of guys on the position player side that help us to avoid calling up Zach Remlard anytime we need somebody to stand at like seven positions.
Yeah, I'm kind of waiting, James, that if another major league team, especially some of the contenders right now, if they have an outfielder that comes down with a serious injury, Tommy Pham feels next to be traded by the White Sox, even though he's just got to Chicago. He is hitting well. He's moving well. He's performing well for the White Sox. Like, that seems to be the next guy that can get dealt. What is this list of players that can be dealt by the White Sox? I mean, is it truly just everyone? Like, I'm sure John Brebbia, the way that he's been pitching well, he's got seven strikeouts in his last three innings of work. Maybe he's someone that could be dealt. Like, is this a lengthy list?
So the list, there's, you can actually find the list. It's at whitesox.com/roster, and you'll see the
so it's
full
everybody.
Breakdown. Brevi looks like they should make calls on him tonight. He looks fantastic. Like, marshal your best offers. Like, it's beginning of season when he's coming off like calf strain in spring before the other calf strain, he looked a little bit like, yeah, this looks like a guy who puts up a high three ERA in the major league bullpen. And then, like, ever since he's come back, it's like, is this the closer? Is this like a preeminent reliever in baseball? He's been fantastic. Like, I mean, if this team like was relevant and mattered, we'd be talking about that escape from the St. Louis bases loaded so much. Like, that was amazing. I think I, for one, though I think like the injury maybe like makes them have to revisit the calculus a little bit. I wouldn't think Robert is like tradable. At least I don't think they want to go that far yet. I don't think they want to announce like, hey, the next 4 years are out to the fan base in some way. Brian Ramos is technically on the roster right now, so I don't think he'll get moved. I guess I need to go ahead and say that. And I don't think like Crochet is not getting traded this month, right? Like, they're too in the weeds of like figuring out what they have and what his actual top value would be. Cause like theoretically, if anything, I think trading him this year is hard because like no team that's acquiring him could really know how many innings they're getting. And right. The idea that he's going to continue to get better, it probably behooves them to see where he's at, you know, a month and a year from now, next year, then try to say like, hey, he's had some good starts, some bad ones, and he might be getting tired. What will you give for us? Like that's probably not the best like way to approach trading. But like, I think a lot of it, like Fetty is 31. It's a year and a half. You're probably going to get another bounty based off this good first half. I don't know if it's necessarily a profile that like, every good first half or every good half season's a given. I think if anything, it's something to explore at the deadline. I think because the system is so pitching heavy, maybe you're a bit more willing to explore with him than like, you know, on the offensive side where he's like the only guy who's hitting and there's a year and a half left of him. Maybe we don't have to rush into this the same way. But I think by and large, like, they won't trade the entire roster. And I think if anything, covering 2017, where we just got excited every time they made a trade, no matter what, like, wow, Ryan Cordell for Anthony Swarzak, Hans a wizard, or cash considerations for Tyler Clifford, Hans a wizard. Like, obviously there's an impact level of trades. Like, we got so wrapped up in the idea, like, well, if they got something for it, it's thus a win. There can be kind of purposeless trades to some degree. Like, the Melky Cabrera trade did not make the White Sox rich forever. I watched Ryan Davis in Kannapolis and kind of thought like, oh, I would trade this guy for a rental. but I would think that it's hard to eliminate people with their current group. Maybe it's like, if anything, I wonder if like the people who perform better put themselves a little bit more on the map. Like, Would you really, if some team was super excited about Gavin Sheets, would you really turn it down? There is a given amount of control, but you know, it's upper 20s. It's not a given, and it hasn't been super consistent up to this point. I think they probably have to think about all of these, whereas like Robbie Grossman, they didn't have to think about it at all, and thus it happened on May 3rd for just a team that ran injuries. And it wasn't so much he boosted his value, which is like, well, we need an outfielder and they're holding some and they don't care. Let's call them. And that the White Sox were that team, which I suppose they could be for a lot of teams.
Yeah, the meaningful trade angle that you just brought up, James, Jim, it got me thinking just now. Drew Thorpe's been great. The players the White Sox have acquired from Dylan Cease have been performing well. Do the White Sox get enough for Cease? Because Cease has been outstanding for San Diego. In 8 starts, a 2.19 ERA, so right back to where he was in 2022, 49 and a third innings, 60 strikeouts to just 16 walks, and he's only allowed 2 homers so far in 2024. Like, again, the players the White Sox have acquired from that Cease trade, they are performing well. But if Cease continues to pitch this well, he's going to be a National League Cy Young finalist. And it just gets me thinking, I hope the White Sox got enough back in return.
Then you would have set the stage for a lot of tweet deleting about people who said, you got to trade Cease before his elbow explodes. What happens if you hold on to him too long and you can't even get Thorpe? And, you know, and then it goes on and on. So that was always the tension. I mean, like, he had a downish season, still, you know, an okay season in terms of durability, and the stuff was mostly good. It's just a matter of, the control was a little bit off and the fastball was a little bit less than it used to be. And the combination just led to some more runs than he was used to. But otherwise, the fundamentals of the pitcher were still the same. And, you know, he was always available and working on trying to, you know, close that last mile of development and make that Cy Young runner-up season less of a, not necessarily a fluke, but just a lot of things did line up for him to have the ERA that he had given how many walks that he issued. So he had a little bit of proving to do on just making sure that, you know, that season, that his place among like top of the rotation pitchers was actually solid. And he's gone out and done that. And I think, you know, were he with the White Sox, I think he'd probably be in a similar position, just because, pretty much all of the preseason work, offseason work was White Sox issued. So there's no reason to think like the Padres suddenly figured out something the White Sox weren't doing. So that's why, like, when it comes to if Getz went into the season with Cease, like, I would have been fine with that, because I think he's not somebody you trade just, you know, to get rid of him or just to get something for him, because with the White Sox, they need a whole lot more than something to make it work. Like, they really had to capitalize on this trade. Fortunately, I think, you know, Thorpe is throwing, you know, really well. Iriarte is off to a really encouraging start. Zavala showing some improvement, still has a long way to go, but at least he's, you know, cut down the strikeout rate considerably in high A. There's enough going on, but yeah, I think Cease is showing why, you know, Getz wouldn't have been completely crazy for hanging on to him in the regular season, because there was some improvement he could have shown. And I think that was the reason why he waited into spring training, was just to show that, oh, the stuff's all the way back. The metrics are sound. He's not masking an injury. It's up to other teams to trust he'll be as healthy as he always is. But, you know, that's why I think he could at least afford to go into spring not having dealt him. And if he waited longer because, like, Thorpe, it was the best he could do and not everybody sold on Thorpe, like, I wouldn't have blamed him for going into the regular season, just because he's, you know, that trade is that important to having the shortest possible time frame for a turnaround.
Opposing hitters are batting just 128 against Dylan Cease in his first 8 starts to the season.
I was watching the Cubs broadcast of Cease's start today, and the latter portions were just like Joe Girardi, like, calmly explaining to the audience, like, listen, there's nothing these men can do. This man cannot be stopped. Like, they're trying their best. There's no options available to them. Like, they just have to take
it. This is going to be a 2-inning game for the Cubs. As soon as Cease gets out, that's their opportunity. The White Sox now come back home after their six-game road trip where they split those two series. They went 3-3 in the road trip. Now they have 7 games, 4 against the Guardians and 3 against the Washington Nationals, in which the Nationals have been playing pretty good baseball. We're going to preview the first 4 games of this series. The Cleveland Guardians are still first place in the American League Central. They have a 2.5-game lead in the division. They're 24-13. And in their last 10 games, though, they're just 5-5 against the American League Central. They are 6-2. They are 2-1 against the White Sox. Your probable pitchers for this series, Thursday and Friday, are 6:40 p.m. Central Time starts. For the Guardians, it's Ben Lively, who's got a 2.08 ERA to start the year, against Eric Fetty. Friday night is Harry Potter night. Carlos Carrasco is making that start for the Guardians, but not the same kind of Carrasco we've seen in past years. Garrett Crochet will take the ball for the White Sox. Saturday, this is a 6:10 p.m. Central Time start. 3/4 zip giveaway, so you'll see a lot of 3/4 zips in the TV shots. Tristan McKenzie will be making that start against Mike Clevinger. And Sunday at 1:10 p.m. Central Time, it is Mother's Day. Logan Allen for the Guardians against Michael Soroka. The White Sox have had success against Logan Allen. They beat him up last time they saw Allen in Cleveland. That's the one win for the White Sox this season. So, gentlemen, I present this. Thursday night, the White Sox are 1-11 in games opening a series. They have been outscored in those games 69-15. However, when Eric Fetty starts, the White Sox are 7-0 against the spread, meaning when they lose, it's only been by one run, or they have straight up won the game like they did in the last Eric Fetty start. Even though Fetty struggled, the White Sox came back and they won that game against the St. Louis Cardinals. You got two conflicting trends intersecting Thursday night. James, you'll be there covering the games for us. Which one do you think will continue Thursday night? The White Sox being god-awful in the opening games to start a series, or another tight contest because of Eric Fetty?
I'm leaning towards god-awful. Cleveland's starting some like 30-something journeyman who I have no idea why he's good, but he's dominating. Probably someone the White Sox haven't seen a lot before. Fetty facing Cleveland's like array of left-handers is one of his rougher starts of the year. He gave up like, I want to say, 3 homers last time he faced them. Though he certainly disproved the assumption a little bit, the Twins, I still don't think, like, you know, as a sinker sweeper guy that like facing a bunch of lefties is his sweet spot, but maybe he's found a little bit more comfort working up in it with his cutter, that he can be a bit more viable than he was last time out. This is also a team without Stephen Kwan now, so they're, you know, 20-30% less pure chaos on the base pass, so that could help. But I feel more dread than assurance about what's going to happen. So I'm gonna lean towards the bad one. I mean, this is, you know, the Rockies are 5 outs away from taking over title as the worst team in baseball. But I don't think I'm quite on the level of the White Sox are coming for everyone and get out of their way. So I'm going to lean towards the bad one.
How about you, Jim? Which trend do you think will continue Thursday night?
Well, with Lively and Fetty, you have two KBO vets going head to head. So that's a subplot. And it would be, yeah, I think it would be emblematic of like Cleveland routing Fetty. Like, you know, all this talk about, you know, how good Fetty's been. And then all of a sudden Lively shows up and outpitches him. And turns out you don't need Brian Bannister when you have Brian Bannister at home. You know, the Guardians just keep, you know, floating on their merry way. But I'm going to say, you know, maybe there's a little bit of regression on everybody's side here. I like that Kwan is out of the lineup because he crushes the White Sox. Even if it's like soft contact, he still crushes the White Sox. So I think there are enough factors here to where I could see the White Sox like doing all right and sneaking out with one and finally, you know, kind of snapping this awful rut they've been on. So I will pick the opposite side of the coin, even though I don't feel certain about it.
All right, so tight game Thursday night. I'm hoping it's a tight game. I'm going to go with Jim. I'm going to say the against the spread trend continues, and the White Sox either lose by one or they win on Thursday night. Because I think that's their best chances of winning games are Thursday and Friday for the White Sox, with Fetty and Crochet starting back-to-back. If they can win those two games, then it'll be a three-game winning streak for the White Sox. I'm not feeling great about Saturday, and the White Sox usually do bat. They do hit Logan Allen well. Sunday could be a high-scoring game with the Guardians facing Michael Soroka on Mother's Day. My last question regarding as far as this series, because, again, we just got a chance to see Cleveland earlier this season, but now they have the third-best record in the American League, a .649 winning percentage. They have a 2.5-game lead in the American League Central. James, are you buying the Guardians here? Do you think they could continue this type of run? Are they really the favorites to win the American League Central now?
Well, they don't have a sausage, so I want to at least know. I think, like, they're the Twins' main rival for the AL Central. I think they have a chance at winning it. They've gotten this far without real pitching depth. Why can't they continue? I don't think they're, you know, 600 winning percentage team. I mostly look up the lineup and wonder how are they this good. I think that they're probably like a gritty 10 games over 500 type of team. Especially if like someone emerges as like a solid regular out of like, you know, all their shortstop prospects they never traded, like Rocchio and Freeman, or if Manzardo like comes up and starts hitting, now they just called him up. But I'm not like there's a superiority to Cleveland baseball that we can't put our finger on type of zealot on them. So I think they'll be in the race all year. I don't think they'll really be a contender outside of the view of the Central, but if they make it and win the Central, I'm sure that they will like be a bunch of national pieces of them in the playoffs that remark mostly to is like, this team is really annoying the major market team we expected to win, and you know, get a lot of pub for that and maybe win a series or two in a way that the opposing team finds the most frustrating experience of their lives. But I don't see them as like, I don't see this as like meaningfully better than like the 2022 team, which was like on, I don't know what that team was running on, sheer Francona energy, the sheer concentrated will of running up the line like your house is on fire. I don't know if we'll ever see that again.
It feels like Kyle Manzardo will have a long way to go in terms of how or whether like this lineup feels more substantial, because for all of the work they've done developing players out of, especially on the pitching side, like out of whole cloth and like second day draft picks, it seems like every other year they have a well-regarded hitting prospect comes up and just can't stick. Like, you know, Bobby Bradley or Oscar Gonzalez briefly hit, like Franmil Reyes. He was supposed to, he's not a prospect, but whether they've acquired guys or like brought them up, they've had guys who are supposed to be able to provide that corner outfield or infield thump. Like even Naylor took a long time to finally like solidify his position. Jake Bauer is another one. Like they've, so with Manzardo, like he's had a couple, brief chances, I think, or at least, this initial audition, 5 strikeouts was like his first audition, but like he's been on the way up, and if he can deliver, because they're not really rushing him, he's had enough time in AAA to where like he deserves an audition. If he comes up thumping the way like he should be able to, or at least like the way he might be able to at his peak, like this lineup looks pretty modular and effective, like the classic Cleveland lineup does. But if what interrupts this offense is like Stephen Kwan being healthy or not, then I think it's kind of a bigger problem in terms of like this offense being a sum that's greater than its parts, and then losing one of those parts that actually, has proven when it comes to offense, defense, base running, etc., being like the ultimate like individual distillation of that ethos. Losing him, like you need somebody to step up, and Manzardo seems like the best bet for that.
I think I'm buying the Guardians at this moment. I'll say I'll buy them because they've only had 3 games against the White Sox. And you take those 3 games out, the Guardians are still 22-12. They're still 10 games above 500. You take the games out for the Twins and Royals, and both of those teams are just one game above 500. Like, the Minnesota Twins being 7-0 against the White Sox, 14-15 against everybody else. And they've been red hot, of course. They had that 12-game winning streak, fueled more than half of those wins were from the White Sox. The Royals are 6-1 against the White Sox. Outside of the White Sox are 16-15. So it has me thinking, like, the Twins and Royals right now are really being propped up having to face the White Sox so many times that maybe after this weekend, this four-game series, the Guardians could take advantage of that. If the Guardians sweep the White Sox, like we've talked about in the last couple of podcasts, can the White Sox determine who wins the AL Central here? Maybe it'll give more credence to their start, and then maybe it could last the entire season. The Guardians surprise everybody and win the American League Central. But it's been pleasant. I mean, outside of the White Sox, I mean, the Tigers are still above 500. They're 19-18 this season. The American League Central has been more competitive, and it's been one of the early surprises to this season. We'll see if it lasts, James, but at least everybody outside of the White Sox has been playing competitive baseball, especially outside the division.
Yeah, I think it's a, you know, higher quality group than it's been in years past. But I will be content to be proven wrong that they are, like, relevant outside of just, like, being tough in this division. I don't see necessarily. I guess the Guardians could, you know, they'll probably be around in the periphery of the wild card race. But yeah, that hurts. I think both them, the Royals, and probably even the Tigers a bit will probably all say, like, we're a year away from, like, when we think we'd really be more relevant, or in the Guardians' case, like, have more of their pieces offensively, or have Mazzardo better installed, or Naylor coming into his, the younger Naylor, coming to his own a bit more. Maybe I think the Guardians probably had a bit bigger expectations for now, but Shane Bieber getting hurt, and that kind of put a little bit more pressure on their young pitching to kind of come up and take the ball, or take the load off than they were accounting for this year. And then I want to say, is it Gavin Williams has been hurt, along with, like, Tanner Beebe not being super great. That's not really given them the ceiling that I thought they could maybe have this year, which is why I'd say, like, the Twins seem to be, like, the one team I thought was, like, other than the fact that, like, they're broke because their TV deal and didn't spend a whole lot, that, like, everything as far as pieces wise, their major core with Correa and Buxton and all that, and Jeffers, you know, coming to his own the way he has, was the team that seemed like this year is, like, their time, and this is, like, in their contention window, and they'll move pieces around the deadline to do that. Whereas I don't know if, like, Detroit breaking in so many offensive pieces and the Royals being the Royals, that this year was necessarily a time that they would make a big push to be relevant beyond just, like, being a tough out in the Central or being within the periphery of that race in August or September.
The American League has been very entertaining. If you have been watching baseball outside of the White Sox, so far there are 9 teams in the American League with a better than 500 record. Only 5 teams in the National League. Lots of 500 teams in the National League, but only 5 teams have a record better than 500. So there have been some really competitive baseball around Major League Baseball. So if you get dour, if things get sad this weekend for the White Sox real quick against the Guardians, take advantage of the games that'll be on the other cable networks. Because again, Sox Machine, we watch the White Sox, so you don't have to. So don't feel like you are forced to watch the White Sox this weekend. There'll be some great baseball around Major League Baseball. And of course, we'll be recapping all the games between the White Sox and Guardians on SoxMachine.com. As I mentioned, James will be there for this homestand covering these 7 games for us. So greatly appreciate everyone's support, the continued support, especially on patreon.com/SoxMachine, so we could have James cover these games for us. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. You could subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to your podcast, such as Spotify and Apple Music. If you do listen to us on YouTube, please subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. You can follow us on social media. We're at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. As I gave a shout out to our Patreon supporters, again, thank you guys so much for your continued support. If you want full access to our coverage of the Chicago White Sox, Go to patreon.com/SoxMachine to sign up today. We have several different tiers of support. Depending on those tiers that you decide, you get additional perks, like an opportunity to be part of a group chat with James, Jim, and I, being able to talk about the White Sox or what's going on in the clubhouse and all the fun off-the-record gossip. So if you're interested in that type of feature and other features that we offer, go to patreon.com/SoxMachine to sign up today. Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside James Fegan and Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers. The trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.